I didn't threaten you.
You said Sergeant Smith thinks I should get the boot. I'd say that's a threat. Lewis hit the stop button and turned to face Hurley. With arms folded, he said, "That was one of the more difficult sessions I've conducted. Do you know why?" Hurley shook his head. "Because I agreed with virtually everything he said." Chapter 18. Stansfield stood at the end of the dock, looked up at the moon, and ran through the list of transgressions. Although he didn't show it, and he never did, he was livid with what was going on down here. He had allowed Hurley far too much latitude, and while much of his anger was directed at the Snake Eater, more of it was directed back at himself. How had he not seen the signs earlier? This place, this operation, all of it was his responsibility. Kennedy had tried to warn him as respectfully as she could, but his days were filled with 100 other pressing issues of national security. And he had a blind spot when it came to Hurley, especially on the operational side of things. He'd known Stan longer than anyone at the company. He knew his long list of talents and his short but potent list of faults. There'd been a few bumps over the years, occasions when Hurley had let him down, but even the great Ted Williams struck out every now and then. They had met in Budapest in the summer of 1956, just as everything was heating up in the unwilling Soviet satellite. Stansfield was in his 30s and was quickly rising through the ranks of the fledgling CIA, while Hurley was in his early 20s, fresh out of training and thirsting for a fight. Stansfield saw firsthand in the run-up to the Hungarian Revolution that Hurley had a real aptitude for mayhem. He was talented and wild, and a lot of other things, some good and some bad, but one thing was undeniable. He knew how to get at the enemy, engage them, upset them, bloody them, and somehow make it back with nothing more than a few bumps. In the espionage business, it was easy to fall into a safe daily pattern. Begin the day at your apartment, head to the embassy for work, a local cafe for lunch, back to the embassy, maybe a cocktail party at another embassy in the evening, a stop at a local cafe for a nightcap, and then back to your apartment. You could safely move about a foreign capital without ever risking your job or your life. Not Hurley. When he landed in a new place, he headed straight for the rough part of town. Got to know the prostitutes, the barkeeps, and most important, the black marketeers who despised their communist overlords. Hurley fed him daily reports about the rising contempt among the citizenry and proved himself to be a first-class field operative. He became Stansfield's indispensable man. Tonight, however, Stansfield was having his doubts. Budapest had been a long time ago. Sooner or later, all skills diminished. The obvious transition was to move him behind a desk, but that would be like asking a racehorse to pull a plow. It would kill him. Stansfield looked back up at the house. He had silently left the meeting and walked down to the lake on his own. A simple hand gesture was enough to tell his bodyguards to wait at the top of the small hill. Hurley would know to come find him. He didn't have to be asked. Stansfield could tell his old colleague was well aware that he had disappointed him. He was as down as he'd seen him in many years, and it could have been because of a variety of factors. At the top of the list was probably that shiner on his face. Stansfield had to bite down on the right side of his tongue when he'd found out that Kennedy's recruit had been the one who'd painted him. Hurley's fighting abilities were unmatched by any man he'd ever encountered. His tolerance for pain, his quickness, his mean streak, his Homeric ability to find the weakness of another man, no matter how big or strong, had become the stuff of legend at Langley. Looking back on it now, Stansfield could see where the mistakes had been made. He had allowed Hurley to create a cult of personality down here, his own little fiefdom of special operations shooters. All of them were extremely talented and useful, but as a group, they had the ability to create a toxic stew of contempt for anyone who had not walked in their shoes. Even Dr. Lewis, a snake eater himself, had voiced concern. Kennedy had repeatedly attempted to nudge him in the right direction. She had the gift, the ability to glimpse where it was all headed. She knew they needed to adapt, change course and tactics, and she'd been trying to get Stansfield's attention. The problem was, as the deputy director of operations, he was in charge of it all. Every valuable operative they had, in every major city all over the globe, and all of the support people who went with him. Virtually, all of it was compartmentalized in some way. And a good portion of it wasn't even put to paper. It was a never-ending chess game that was played in his head every day, all day long. Stansfield heard the soft footfalls on the stairs coming down to the lake. He turned and made out the image of Hurley in the moonlight. The platform swayed as he stepped onto the L-shaped dock. Hurley approached his boss without a word and pulled out a pack of Camels. He offered his old friend one, knowing that he liked to acquaint himself with his old habit when he was away from his wife. The two men stood facing the lake, looking up at the starry night sky, puffing on their cigarettes for nearly a minute, before Hurley finally spoke. "I fucked up." Stansfield gave no reply, just a simple nod of agreement. "Maybe it's time I call it quits." Stansfield turned his head a few degrees to look at Hurley and said, "I will tolerate a lot of things from you, but self-pity is not one of them. You've never been a quitter, and you're not going to start now." "I got my ass beat by a college puke. You got your healthy ego bruised is what happened. You don't understand, it should have never happened. I still can't explain how it happened. I'm not getting any younger, but even on an off day, I'm still better than 99.9% of the guys out there." "I know math was never your strong suit, but the answer is pretty obvious." "What the hell is that supposed to mean?" "If you can beat 99.9% of the guys out there, and he bested you, that means he's in the 0.1%. Hurley shook his head. "I don't see how it's possible. Not enough training." "You don't see it because you don't want to. I did a little checking on my own. Irene's find is an exceptionally gifted athlete. He's considered a bit of a freak of nature in the world of lacrosse. Did you know he's considered to be one of the greatest college lacrosse players of all time?" "What in hell does that have to do with fighting?" "A great athlete can learn almost anything, and do it a lot quicker than an average athlete," Stansfield said firmly. "Your big problem, though, is that you allowed your personal disdain for anyone who hasn't worn the uniform to cloud your judgment."
Still
nothing," Stansfield cut him off. "The boy is a three-time All-American and national champ. You got thumped by a world-class athlete
who has no real training. You yourself said he's been taking classes. Rolling around some mat at a strip mall is not training."
Stansfield let out a tired sigh. It was his way of releasing pressure so he didn't blow. "Some people you could gently tap with a finishing hammer a few times, and they would get the point. Not Hurley, though. You had to hit the man square in the forehead with a sledgehammer repeatedly to get your point across."
"Sorry," Hurley said meekly. "I'm still having a hard time buying this kid's story."
"You are possibly the most stubborn person I have ever met, and that's saying a lot. You have used that to your advantage many times, but it has also gotten you into a fair amount of trouble. And before you get all sensitive on me, this is coming from the guy who had to get you out of all that trouble over the years. I've called in a lot of favors to pull your ass out of the fire, so hear me when I tell you that this issue is moot. The kid beat you, and quite honestly, I don't care how he did it, or where he learned how to do it. The fact is he did it, and that makes him a very desirable recruit." Hurley finally got it.
"What do you want me to do?"
"Fix it."
"How do I fix it if I'm not even sure where I fucked up?"
"Stop being so conveniently modest. You know where you made mistakes. It's just not in your nature to confront them, so dig a little harder and they'll turn up. And by the way, I made a few mistakes of my own. Ultimately, you are my responsibility." Stansfield glanced back up at the house. "That last hour in there was one of the most embarrassing of my career." Hurley was too embarrassed himself to speak.
"We're supposed to know better," Stansfield continued. "We're the veterans, and we just had two kids point out something that we both should have caught. There was a day when I knew better. To put it mildly, you are an organizational nightmare. You belong in the field. I think this..." Stansfield held his arms out and motioned at the nature around them, "lulled me into thinking that you are in fact in the field, but you're not.
You're too corralled down here.
Then let me go active again, Hurley said in an almost pleading voice.
Stansfield mulled the thought over while taking one last puff. There were any number of sayings that could be applied to the espionage trade, but few were as appropriate as the phrase, "nothing ventured, nothing gained." At some point you had to jump into the game. Stansfield had grown weary of receiving secure cables telling him that another one of his assets had been picked off by these radical Islamists. It was time to start hitting back.
"Stan, these Islamists aren't going away. I've been telling you that for 10 years.
Looking at the big picture, they've been a minor irritation until now, but I sense something bigger. They are organizing and morphing and spreading like a virus.
You can thank the damn Saudis and the Iranians for that."
That was true, Stansfield thought. Very few people understood the bloody rivalry between the Sunnis and the Shias. Each sect was growing more radical, more violent. They couldn't wait any longer. Stansfield lowered his voice.
"Stan, in 6 months' time, I want you operational. Stop trying to run these kids down like it's a special forces selection process. Irene's right. I don't really care if they can survive in the forest for a week with nothing more than a fingernail clipper. I want them ready for urban operations. I'm going to task Doc to you full-time. Listen to him. He knows what he's doing."
"Okay. And after 6 months?" Hurley asked, with a bit of optimism in his voice.
"I'm going to turn you loose. We need to hit these guys back. At a bare minimum, I want them lying awake at night, worried that they might be next. I want you to scare the shit out of them."
Hurley smiled in anticipation.
"I know just what to do."
"Good. And one last thing. You're almost 60. This is a young kid's game, especially your side of the business. Our days are numbered. We need to start trusting these kids more. In another 10 years, they're going to take over, and we'll probably be dead."
Hurley smiled.
"I'm not going down without a fight."
Chapter 19. Beirut, Lebanon. Syed mopped his brow with a rag. The front of his white T-shirt was splattered with the blood of the man who had just confessed to myriad sins. The basement was warm and damp, and he'd been at it for most of the day. He couldn't remember the last time he'd had to work so hard to get a man to talk. He was thirsty and hungry, but both needs would have to wait. They were gathered upstairs, nervously waiting to hear what he'd discovered. Syed dropped the pliers on the metal cart. The device bounced and fell open, the serrated clamps releasing a bloody fingernail. There were 8 total, strewn about the stainless steel surface, sticky and gooey with blood and tissue. Syed admired his work for a second. Every man was different. For some, the mere threat of physical pain was enough to get them to admit their deception. Others, like this Jewish pig, took a little more work. He'd employed many different methods to get at the truth, but he preferred fingernails and toenails for the simple reason that there were 20 of them. And they grew back. Syed had seen torture practiced in a wide variety of forms. Most sessions were brutish and conducted without forethought or planning. Slapping and kicking was the most common method, but employed against a man who had been desensitized to such things, it was more often than not useless. There were stabbing and slicing and shooting, and although they worked, they also required medical care if you were going to continue to interrogate the individual. There was degradation, such as shoving a man's head in a bucket full of human excrement, sticking things in orifices where they didn't belong, and a long list of things Syed found distasteful. Electrocution was the only other form that Syed would use. It was extremely effective and clean. Its only downside was the potential for heart failure and long-term brain and nerve damage. Syed liked to spend time with his subjects. To truly debrief a prisoner took months. Syed could never understand why people would so casually throw away such a valuable commodity. Killing a subject after he admitted to his lies was foolish. As an interrogator, you had barely scratched the surface. An admission of guilt was just that, and often nothing more. The truly valuable information lay buried in the subject's brain and needed to be slowly and carefully coaxed to the surface. And to do that, you needed time. Syed wiped his hands on a blood-smeared towel and said to one of the guards, "Clean the wounds and bandage the fingers. I don't want him getting an infection." He put on his black dress shirt and left the interrogation room. He continued past the guards and up one flight of stairs. There were a dozen men milling about the lobby. Most were in plain clothes. A few wore fatigues, but all were armed with rifles and sidearms. Syed continued up another flight of stairs to the second floor, where he found more armed men milling about the hallway. He frowned at the sight of them. The presence of so many men was bound to draw attention. His colleagues were far too one-dimensional. They were still thinking of their struggle as a ground battle between vying factions. Car bombs, snipers, and assaults must always be taken into account, but the bigger threat at the moment was the jets flown by Jews and the Americans. These men had not walked here, which meant there were far too many cars parked in front of the building. Syed traveled with a light contingent of bodyguards for this very reason. Three or four were usually more than enough. The others were either too paranoid, too proud, or too stupid to see the folly of traveling in such large motorcades. Eight guards were standing in the hallway outside the office at the back of the building. Syed approached one of the more recognizable faces and said, "I pray for the sake of our struggle that no more than six vehicles are parked in front of this building." The man looked in the direction of the street, and without answering took off at a trot. Syed was pleased that at least one of these morons knew how to take orders. He opened the door to the office and found four faces instead of the three he had expected. Mustafa Badruddin, the leader of Islamic Jihad, was at the head of the table. To his right was the leader of Islamic Jihad's paramilitary wing, Imad Bugnia, and then Colonel Amir Jalil of the Iranian Quds Force. He was Iran's liaison between Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah. The last man, Abu Radi, was not welcome, at least not as far as Syed was concerned. He was the representative for Fatah, the extremely unreliable band of men who claimed to speak on behalf of the approximately 500,000 Palestinians living in Lebanon. In Syed's conservative opinion, they were nothing more than a gang of organized mobsters who stumbled from one confrontation to the next, leaving a trail of havoc in their wake. They were only good for two things: to use as a buffer against the Jews to the south, or as cannon fodder against the Christian militias to the east. "Well?" Colonel Jalil asked. Syed ignored the Iranian and turned instead to Mustafa Badruddin.
"CIA.
"I knew it,"
Radi said excitedly. Syed glanced at the imbecile who had created the problem and said,
"You knew no such thing."
"I did so,"
Radi said defensively.
"How could you have possibly known? What evidence did you have in your possession that pointed to the fact that this man was CIA?
"I have my sources."
Syed laughed at him. It was an empty claim, and everyone in the room knew it. "And the businessman you kidnapped last week, what has he told you?"
"He admitted that he is an American agent."
Syed was dubious of the claim, but the fool had just painted himself into a corner. "In that case, I will need you to turn him over to me." Radi realized his mistake.
"Well, he has admitted to a lot of things. My men are not done interrogating him."
Syed stared at him with a look that told everyone in the room that he didn't believe a word of it.
"I will give you a report in a few days,"
Radi said. Syed dismissed him with a look of contempt and addressed the other men. The man downstairs is an employee for the CIA, who has spent the better part of the last 4 years in Damascus. My government will want to assess the damage he has caused. To do that thoroughly, I will need Radi to transfer his hostage to me. I'm afraid this point is not negotiable."
"But he is my hostage,"
Radi said, half yelling.
"It was my operation."
"An operation that was not approved."
Radi ignored the point and said,
"He is extremely valuable. He has told us his company will pay a large sum to get him back."
"Not if he is an American agent."
Syed shook his head sadly and scratched his thick black beard. "As we know all too well, the Americans do not negotiate for hostages, especially the CIA. Pointing at the ceiling, he added, they are far more likely to track him down and drop a bomb on all of us. The other man shared nervous looks.
The other American, the one you grabbed in front of this hotel last week,
Badruddin said to the Fatah leader,
he has told you implicitly that he is an agent?
It is my suspicion,
Radi said, thankful for the breathing room.
What was he doing in Beirut? He works for one of their big telecommunications companies.
Radi blathered on about his prisoner, but Syed was only half listening. The CIA man in the basement had verified the fact that the other man was a legitimate businessman, but Syed did not feel like coming to the aid of the twit from Fatah. He would only know for certain after spending months interrogating the men. Syed looked at Mughniya and said,
some men are very good liars. It takes a skilled hand to discern the truth from these Americans.
Mughniya nodded and spoke for the first time.
I don't like the coincidence. We should turn him over to Syed. He will get to the bottom of it.
Syed was quietly pleased. Mughniya had a reputation for killing those who crossed him. Radi would not want to defy him.
The entire thing gives me great concern, the Iranian chimed in.
Syed could barely stand the man. He was a self-proclaimed intellectual who was part of the rabble who had helped bring down the Shah and bring about the Islamic Revolution of Iran.
It cannot be a good sign that the Americans are back, Jalil said, as he caressed his bottom lip with the forefinger of his right hand. Nothing good can come from them poking around in our business.
I will find out what they are up to, Syed said confidently.
The three men exchanged looks, ignoring Radi, who was growing more agitated by the second. Badruddin spoke for the group. Turning to Radi, he said,
please transfer your hostage to Syed as soon as it's possible.
That means tonight, Syed said, not wanting to give the man an inch.
That is impossible, Radi said, as if they were asking him to fly to the moon. This man is too valuable. I am more than capable of finding out his true identity.
With a casual flip of his hand, he said, I will give all of you a report within a few days.
That will not work, Syed held his ground. I want him tonight.
I will not give him to you. He is my prisoner.
Mughniya leaned forward in his chair and glared at the representative from Fatah. The temperature seemed to drop a few degrees.
I don't remember your seeking our permission to conduct this operation in the first place.
And when was the last time any of you came to me to ask permission to launch an operation?
With an icy voice, Mughniya said,
I do not need your permission.
That hardly seems fair.
You are invited to these meetings as a courtesy. Nothing else.
The rest of you have taken hostages for years, and have profited greatly while the rockets of retaliation rained down on my people, and I did not complain to you. Now all I am asking is that I be allowed to share in the spoils of war. You have not allowed me to partner on any of your other business ventures, so I must take what is rightfully mine.
With a look of sadness, he added,
I have given nothing but loyalty, and this is how you treat me.
Mughniya threw his arms up in frustration. He looked at Badruddin and Jalil.
Talk some sense into him before I shoot him.
Syed didn't let it show, but he was enjoying every minute of this. Badruddin sighed heavily and said,
this is only temporary. Hand the man over to Syed. He is without question the best man to do the job. When he is done, if the man is in fact a businessman, he will turn him back over to you, and you can then negotiate a ransom. That is fair.
Radi shifted nervously in his chair. He did not want to give up the man, but he could not defy these four. Any one of them could have him killed before the sun rose again. He could see what Syed was up to. The hostage could be worth as much as several $1 million if he did in fact work for the telecommunications company, and once the man was out of his hands, he would be lucky to get half of the ransom. Still, half was better than being dead. With great reluctance, he said,
fine.
And then, glancing sideways at Syed, he added,
you can interrogate him at my camp.
Syed laughed. Nice try.
Why not?
Because I said so. I do not need to explain such things to you.
He is being unreasonable, Radi said to the other three.
Before they could answer, Syed said, I need to inform Damascus of this situation, and I need to continue my discussion with the American agent.
I expect Radi to have his prisoner here by 10 o'clock tonight so I can get to the bottom of this, and I suggest you all leave as quickly as possible. He glanced at the ceiling. The four of us, he said, intentionally leaving Radi out, are far too tempting a target, and with the American in the basement, who knows what they are up to these days? They may have other spies in the area. Moving toward the door, he said, with absolute finality, I will have more answers for you tomorrow.
Part 2 Chapter 20 Istanbul, Turkey. Of all the changes Rapp had to make over the 6 months of his training, adjusting to the solitude had been the most challenging. As he became increasingly immersed in his new trade, he drifted further and further away from his friends. The big change was not that he didn't see them as much. It was a mental detachment. With each new level of training, they had less in common. His new life was far from social. Rapp's childhood had been fairly normal. He'd grown up in a nice upper-middle-class suburb of Washington, D.C., and pretty much stayed out of trouble. He did well in school, although some subjects, like French, were far easier than math and science. He excelled at every sport, which guaranteed a certain level of acceptance among his peers. There had been just one setback, and it was a pretty big one. When Rapp was 13, his father dropped dead of a massive heart attack. It was a heavy blow, but Rapp didn't go into a complete freefall, nor did he retreat into a shell. The truth was, his dad wasn't around much. He was a workaholic, who golfed on the weekends. He was in no way a bad father. He was fair and honest with his two boys, and as far as Rapp could tell, he had been faithful to his mother and treated her with the respect she deserved. It was neither bad or good, it just was. Rapp had a tight group of friends in the neighborhood, and his father had been wise enough to take out the right amount of life insurance, so very little on the home front changed. The awkward moments came at the sports banquets, where he was the only one without a father, and the holidays, when the memories of his father inevitably bubbled to the surface, but through it all, he was more concerned about his little brother and mother. There was one area where it definitely changed him. He wanted stability in his personal relationships. His friends became more important than ever. Not that they hadn't been before, it was just that he had never had to think about it. All he had to do was walk out his front door, get on his bike, and within a block or two he couldn't help but stumble onto a basketball or stickball game. More than anything, though, his father's death taught him that the clock was ticking. Everyone was going to die. Some a lot sooner than others, but in the end, there was no avoiding it, and since he wasn't a Hindu, he pretty much figured he'd better make the best of his one shot. This drove him with amazing intensity and focus on fields and courts of his youth. And then there was Mary. Rapp met her when he was 16. He was playing baseball and she was running track. He didn't know if it was love at first sight because he hadn't a clue what love was. But it was unlike anything he'd ever experienced. It was like every great emotion he'd ever felt all rolled into one euphoric wave, and it scared the crap out of him because he instantly knew he was not in control. Fortunately, she was, and she had the sense and stability to not jerk him around too much. Her father was a captain in the Navy and a huge lacrosse fan. With three daughters of his own, he enthusiastically attended Rapp's lacrosse matches. Rapp and Mary dated all through high school, and then headed off to Syracuse together, where Mary ran track and eventually landed in the Newhouse School of Public Communications. Her ambitious plan was to become a sports announcer. On a chilly December night in 1988, Mary was returning home from a semester abroad when her plane was blown out of the sky, killing 259 passengers and crew and 11 more innocent souls on the ground in Lockerbie, Scotland. The terrorist attack that became known as Pan Am Lockerbie hit Rapp like a hammer blow. They had planned their entire life together. They'd discussed kids, ambitions, and fears, but never once did they think that one of them would be taken. If he'd made it through the death of his father relatively intact, the opposite was true this time. He crumbled. He was already home for Christmas break and planning on picking Mary up at Dulles after she'd connected through JFK. Strangely enough, when he received the news, he never questioned it. Never challenged it, never asked for proof. The downing of the plane was all over the news, and there was no doubt that she was on it. She'd called him from Heathrow right before she'd boarded. It was a wreck for the first week. He refused to see a soul, including Mary's parents. And then, on the morning of her funeral, he emerged from the basement, shaved, and wearing a suit and tie. His mother and his brother, Stephen, accompanied him to the funeral, where he sat, stone-faced, in a state of bewildered shock. Midway through the service, though, something happened. The shock, the pain, the agonizing self-pity over the fact that he would never see her again, never hold her, never smell her. The list went on and on and on like some pounding surf that threatened to drown him. Sitting in that pew that morning, listening to all of the crying, witnessing all of the pain and loss, made him want to make a break for it. He didn't want to share his heartache with these people. None of them knew her the way he did. It was his dreams that had been dashed, his life that had been turned upside down and wrecked. Self-pity was something he had never experienced before, and it sickened him. Rapp took his pathetic, self-absorbed emotion and shoved it as far down in his gut as it would go, and he plugged it with the first and only thing he had available, anger. That anger slowly metastasized into a suit of armor. For the first time since the news had hit him, he saw a way out, a faint light at the far end of the cavern. He wasn't sure what it was, but he knew he had to head toward it. It was the only thing that offered him hope. The rest of these people could sit around and feel sorry for themselves and each other, but not him. He wanted to hurt someone. He wanted to make someone pay. He didn't know for certain that he would achieve his goal, but he knew with absolute certainty that he wanted to kill the men who were responsible for bringing down that plane. Rapp didn't know if it was right or wrong, and he didn't care. All he knew was that the anger kept the pain at bay. Rapp and Hurley had developed a hate-hate relationship. The shrink had told him it didn't really matter as long as they were united in their hatred for the enemy. It had been a strange 6 months, and looking back on the journey, Rapp was amazed that he'd made it through without any serious injury. He was young enough going in to be fearless, but coming out on the other end, looking back at what he'd been through, was another story. It was a little like being told not to look down while on the high wire. You just take it one step at a time. And when you get to the other side, and reality sets in, you think you must have been off your rocker to ever try it in the first place. Rapp could point to a specific date and time when the physical hell and mental abuse had all but vanished. It was replaced by 18-hour days that were structured to the minute and more academic than grueling. There were still long runs and lots of push-ups and pull-ups, but they were designed to keep them in peak shape, not to try to get them to quit. The low point was the day after he'd broken Victor's arm. For the first week, they were rousted at 5 every morning. Rapp didn't need an alarm. He was on his feet as soon as the door was opened. But on the morning after the incident with Victor, Rapp found himself thrown from his cot and rolling across the dusty floor. After landing with a thud, he came up swinging. It was still dark, and his muscles were tight, and he never saw the blow that came out of the darkness. It hit him in the solar plexus, and as Rapp doubled over from the first strike, another punch hammered his left eye. Rapp hit the floor and lay there gulping for air like a largemouth bass flopping around on a dock. The lights suddenly came on, and with them the insults came raining down from the mouth of the mean old cuss. He stood over Rapp, his fists clenched, a look of smug satisfaction on his face. If Rapp had had a gun at that moment, he would more than likely have killed the man. The 4 remaining recruits were ordered outside, and for the next 4 hours were forced to endure unimaginable tortures. One man collapsed from exhaustion, and another simply quit. It was now down to just Rapp and Fred. That was when the bastard turned all of his attention on Rapp. By noon, they were down to 1. It was an unwarranted slap to the back of the head that did Rapp in. As calmly as possible, he turned to face the old man and told him, "If you ever slap me again, I'm going to put you in the hospital." The old man ordered Rapp into the barn, and they went at it again. This time, Rapp lost fair and square, or so he thought at first. As he lay there on the mat, bloodied and exhausted, he realized what had happened. The old man didn't think he could take him fair and square, so he ran Rapp into the ground first. He dumped him from his cot at 4 a.m. and spent the next 8 hours wearing him down and tenderizing him. Rapp never had a chance. The old prick had made it personal, and in Rapp's mind, that did not reflect well on the organization he thought he was joining. The whole thing was starting to look and smell like a shit show. Rapp got to his feet, told the old bastard exactly what he thought of him, and quit. Rapp packed his stuff and was almost to the gate when the shrink caught up with him. He tried to talk Rapp out of quitting, and when that didn't work, he outright asked him to stay. Rapp still didn't budge, so Lewis put all the cards on the table. He formally introduced himself and admitted that Victor was, in fact, one of the instructors. He explained that he had vigorously protested using him to infiltrate the recruits. Rapp asked him for the old cuss's name, but Lewis refused. "If you stay and make it through the rest of the training, you will find out who he is, but short of that, I cannot oblige you." When Rapp held his ground, Lewis told him only that the old man was not the most likable guy, but he assured Rapp that he was exceedingly good at his craft. He assured Rapp that the nonsense was over and that from this moment forward, they would be focusing on tradecraft. Rapp still wavered. He simply couldn't see how it was possible for the old cuss to change his behavior. Lewis, sensing Rapp's indecision, said, "You're one of the best I've ever seen. We could really use you. In a way that might explain why he's so hard on you." Rapp finally relented. It was down to just him and Fred. They still began every day with a workout, but the rest of the time was spent either in the classroom, in the barn, on the pistol range, or on field exercises to Richmond and then to Atlanta. They employed their skills against random targets, unwitting businessmen. They followed them, surveilled their every move, and looked for the right opportunity to dispatch them. Everything was analyzed and critiqued by Lewis and the old man. While at the lake house, they were allowed to speak only Arabic. They honed their fighting skills with virtually every conceivable weapon. They focused on knives and guns, for the most part, but they were also taught to inventory every room they entered for objects that could be used to defend or kill. A day didn't go by where the old cuss didn't remind them of the endgame. He was turning them into killers. They studied physiology until they had an intimate understanding of the best ways to either dispatch or incapacitate an opponent. They became expert marksmen with a variety of pistols, shooting with both left and right hands. They were taught escape and evasion techniques, explosives, and the tricks of the counter-surveillance trade. As a final step, Rapp and Fred were told that if anything went wrong, they were on their own. Embassies and consulates were off-limits. The United States government didn't know they existed, and it sure as hell wasn't going to claim them if they landed in hot water. The mean old cuss asked them if they accepted this. If they didn't, they could walk away right now, no questions asked. After only brief consideration, both men said they fully understood the need for plausible deniability. They were in. Early then formally introduced himself and told Rapp and Fred they were now free to reveal to each other their real identities. Rapp and Fred had already done this several months earlier, but they went through the motions as if it were the first time. After that, they were forced to memorize a lengthy list of addresses and phone numbers across Europe and the Middle East. A day did not pass without Hurley's reminding them that the United States government had no knowledge of their existence. If they were caught doing something illegal in a foreign country, they were on their own. There would be no cavalry or diplomatic effort to gain their release. As often as Hurley brought it up, Rapp did not dwell on it, for the simple reason that he didn't plan on getting caught. Chapter 21. As planned, Rapp was the first one to arrive in the former capital city of the Byzantine Empire. He'd been given a long list of orders, and one of them was to stay away from the safe house until it was dark. It was February, and the temperature was in the mid-50s. Rapp took the tram to the Beaulieu district, found a men's room, retrieved a few objects from his luggage, and then deposited the suitcase in a locker and set about exploring the area which he'd already memorized by map. He was immediately taken by the scope of the city, as well as its rich history. He'd traveled to London and Paris previously, and Istanbul rivaled them in every way. The images of London and Paris were well known throughout the Western world, but Istanbul, far more rich in history, had in a way been forgotten by people in Europe and America. After stopping for a quick bite at a café, Rapp made his way toward the Galata neighborhood, where their target lived. Hurley had given him specific orders to stay clear of both the target's apartment and his office. Rapp had not made a conscious decision to defy the order. It more or less just happened. As he turned onto Bankalar Caddesi, or Banks Street, he couldn't help but walk past the target's place of work, along with several hundred other people who crowded the sidewalk. Rapp passed on the opposite side of the street and noted the bank guard standing next to the front door. With that done, he decided he might as well take a look at the man's apartment, which was 6/10 of a mile from the office. It was on a tree-lined street that reminded Rapp of a much smaller version of the Boulevard Montmartre in Paris. It was a wealthy enclave, and as in all such enclaves in cities the world over, the occupants were protected from the riffraff by security guards, ornate fences, and iron bars on the first-floor windows. At first glance, neither the office nor the apartment looked like the ideal place to strike. When the sun finally set, Rapp found his way to the two-bedroom flat via a back alley. He went by once without stopping to check and see if there were any surprises, and then circled back. In the poor light, he threaded the worn key into the lock and held his breath. The first attempt didn't work. Rapp jiggled the key a bit and then tried again. This time, the deadbolt released. He stepped into the room, barely breathing, and closed the door behind him. He stood statue-like, all of his senses on high alert. This apartment was the only definitive link to him in the entire city of 12 million people. Hurley had warned him that this was the second most dangerous moment when conducting an operation. Rapp asked him what was the most dangerous, and the old man had replied with a devilish smile, "When you engage the target." After dropping his bag, he locked the door and found the wall switch. Two small wall sconces cast a yellow light over the room. He fished a large rubber doorstop from his suitcase and wedged it under the door. He couldn't help but smile to himself as he thought of Hurley's rules. The man even had rules about how to go to the bathroom. Some of them, like the rubber doorstop, made complete sense, while others, like which stall to choose and why, seemed a bit much. Rapp checked the windows next. They had bars, which were padlocked. There was only one way in and out, the door he'd just come through. That was not the best situation should the police come looking for them. Rapp made sure the shades were pulled tight on the two garden-level windows that faced the alley, and then he went straight for the bedroom. At the bottom of the armoire, under an extra blanket and pillow, he found what he was looking for. Rapp placed the tattered leather suitcase on the bed, dialed in the combinations, and popped the clasps. Inside was a shrink-wrapped file, a small arsenal of pistols, silencers, ammunition, knives, and a surveillance kit. Rapp snapped on a pair of latex gloves and retrieved a Beretta 92F from the foam cutout. He checked the slide, the chamber, the firing pin, and then the trigger. The gun had been cleaned by a pro. After screwing a silencer to the end, he took one of the 15-round magazines and inserted it, chambered around, and checked the safety. Rapp then set about doing a complete examination of the apartment. He retrieved the electric razor from his shaving kit, pressed two buttons, waited for the light to blink. The shaver was actually a scanning device used to detect bugs. Hurley had explained that the flat had been rented by a freelancer, which in this case was code for a retired agency employee. The man was to sanitize and stock the flat, but Rapp had been ordered to go over the entire place again from top to bottom just to make sure. It took him the better part of an hour to go over the entire apartment. When the jet lag finally caught up with him, Rapp was too tired to make anything to eat, so he took a quick shower and then tore the shrink wrap from the file. He'd been given a full briefing on Hamdi Sharif back in the States, but this file, he was told, would be far more target-specific. The target was 58 years old. He was a Turkish national, and according to press clippings, had made his money in real estate. What the clippings left out was that the majority of his wealth had come from supplying arms to various regimes throughout the Middle East and Southwest Asia. British, French, and American intelligence agencies all had his number, but Sharif was in bed with the Russians, which made him a bit of a sticky situation. None of the Allies wanted to risk upsetting the Russians, so they tolerated him. Rapp frowned as he reviewed the section on Sharif's ties with the tangled web of former Soviet generals and Ivankov-lately millionaire businessmen. All but a few were thugs and mafiosi, and the legitimate businessmen were being dropped and squeezed out of their holdings on a weekly basis. Russia had become the Wild West, and the sheriff was in on the fix. The KGB brutes had new business cards, but other than that, not much had changed. The Allies, for some reason, couldn't see that the more they turned a blind eye, the more brazen these men were becoming. Rapp could give a rat's ass about the Russians and who they used to peddle their arms, so long as those arms didn't end up in the laps of terrorists. Unfortunately for Sharif, that was precisely what he had been doing, and in ever-increasing shipments. Most of the file was a summary of what Rapp already knew, such as his ties to Hezbollah, but there were a few new snippets about a Marxist outfit called Dev Sol. In the past year, the group had targeted the overseas offices of 15 U.S. corporations in Istanbul. The bombs were all military-grade, and the Brits were saying Sharif's outfit had supplied the goods. Sharif was a Muslim and an ardent supporter of Hezbollah, Hamas, and Fatah. How he had ended up in business with a bunch of leftist, God-hating communists was a real head-scratcher. The file didn't draw any conclusions, just gave the facts. Rapp was left to venture guesses on his own. He supposed it was money first, and then the old saying, "My enemy's enemy is my friend." The Dev's soul wrinkle gave Rapp pause, however. He got the sense that this might be about more than just Pan Am Lockerbie, or at least that certain important people stateside don't care so much when innocent civilians get killed, but by God, if the day-to-day operations of a couple of Fortune 500 companies were disrupted, it was time to send a message. Those corporations contributed a lot of money to the coffers of important politicians in Washington. The more Rapp thought about it, the more he realized it didn't matter. It was like Sharif supporting Dev Sol, as long as he and the corporations were going after the same enemy. It didn't much matter. Rapp finished the file and stuffed it under the mattress. He lay there for a long moment with his eyes open, thinking about the detailed report. It was written in English, but it had not been written by an American. The choice of words was distinctive and the sentence structure more formal. Rapp concluded the Brits had put the report together and that they had taken a long, hard look at solving the Sharif problem. They had conducted careful surveillance on the arms dealer. His daily routine was detailed down to the minute. The report didn't say how long they had watched him, but he got the impression it was for several weeks. Rapp remembered that the shrink back at the lake house had told him you could discern patterns in almost any person's life. In reading Sharif's file, those patterns jumped off the page, and one in particular was almost impossible to ignore. Rapp's mind began to wander down a path that he should have steered clear of, but he found it impossible to resist. After a few minutes, he set the alarm on his watch, turned off the bedside lamp, glanced at the loaded pistol, closed his eyes, and began to drift away. Hurley's orders couldn't have been more clear, but it would be two more days before he arrived in the city. Rapp began to imagine how he would do it. The act of his first kill played out in his mind like a movie. As he drifted off to sleep, he decided he would go for a nice long run in the morning. And he would break another one of Hurley's rules. Chapter 22. Rapp awoke, rested, and went through the motions of his morning routine without coming to grips with what he had for the most part already decided. He shaved, drank a glass of orange juice, and mixed some granola and yogurt into a small bowl. He read the file again while eating. He started with the summary and worked his way back to see if he'd missed anything. After reading it a second time, he was even more convinced that it had been prepared by the Brits, which led to a very obvious question. Why had they decided not to act? It could have been as simple as Hurley or someone at Langley offering to solve the problem for them. Rapp had been trying to decipher the organizational structure of the team that was centered on the Lake Anna House for some time now. There had to be more people involved than the handful of operatives he'd met. After Rapp had proved himself worthy of joining their endeavor, the veil of secrecy was lifted a notch. His recruiter gave him her real name, although he had no way of knowing if it in fact was her real name. Irene Kennedy was the only person in the small group who actually worked at Langley. According to her, everyone else was a contractor. Rapp asked the obvious question, "What am I?" Kennedy thought about it for a second and said, "Does it matter to you?" "Maybe." "Technically, you don't work for the CIA."
"But I work for you."
"That's correct. The important thing is that you have no record of ever working for the federal government, and we'd like to keep it that way." Rapp thought long and hard about what he was about to say.
"So, I'm a hired gun."
Kennedy's squinting eyes showed that she wasn't exactly in love with the label. Rapp surprised her even more by what he said next. "How about assassin?" She frowned. "No. By my estimate, I've fired around 20,000 rounds of ammunition since arriving here." "And you've become quite the marksman." "And what's the point of all of this training? To keep shooting paper targets? Or to eventually sink a bullet into a target's head?" "You know the answer."
He did. "Remember the first time we met?" She nodded. "You told me there are people in Washington who think that we need to take a more aggressive approach with these terrorists."
"Yes."
"But they don't have the courage to say so publicly."
"It would be foolish for them to do so. We live in a civilized society. They would be thrown out of office."
"And a civilized society would never condone assassination, even in instances where it involved national security."
"Not unless we were at war. And even then it would be tricky." Rapp digested that for a moment and then said, "I'm not into semantics. Private contractor, hired gun, operative." He shook his head. "Killer, the point of all of this is to go out and find the enemy and put a bullet in his head, right?"
"I suppose that is an accurate definition."
"I suppose the answer is yes."
"So I'm an assassin."
"Not yet," she offered with a sly smile. "You haven't killed anyone." Rapp looked in the mirror at his reflection and wondered if he really knew himself. The college athlete looked back at him with the innocence of youth. The public face in no way jibed with the thoughts of retribution that filled his head. Inside, he was a much older man, a jaded, hard man who was now a trained killer. He thought again of his conversation with Kennedy and his new profession. He was ready, eager really, but not in a reckless way. More methodical, perhaps, than at any time in his life. He asked himself again if he should proceed with his plan. The answer came back, a resounding yes. Rapp secured the silenced Beretta in a shoulder holster and covered it with a lightweight blue and silver reversible running jacket. He stuffed one of the surveillance kits into a fanny pack and strapped the pack to his waist. He put a dark blue Nike baseball hat on his head and checked himself in the full-length mirror on the inside door of the armoire. There was a slight bulge under his right arm where the 9mm was holstered. As a last measure, he grabbed a white towel from the bathroom and looped it around the back of his neck. He stuffed the ends inside the running jacket, zipped it up, and checked himself in the mirror. The bulge was no longer noticeable. Rapp lowered the zipper, turned to the side, and stuck his left hand inside the jacket. He gripped the Beretta and attempted to aim the weapon. The silencer caught on the jacket. He tried again, this time partially drawing the weapon but keeping it hidden inside the jacket. He found it worked best if he raised his right arm, as if he were checking the time on his wristwatch. Rapp practiced the move 50 more times until he was completely comfortable with it. Finally, he checked the alley and then left the apartment, locking the door behind him. He decided to skip stretching before the run, no sense in giving the neighbors time to observe him. Whenever possible, reconnaissance is best done on foot.
A satellite can't give you the smells and sounds of a neighborhood, and it can't see what might be lurking behind a window or under the awning of an apartment building. A car isn't bad, but then again, cars usually travel at fairly high speeds, placing them in the area of concern for a few seconds at most. Often, they were the only choice, but in this situation, walking the neighborhood was the best option. Or in Rapp's case, running it. It took off at a trot. From studying the file, Rapp knew there was a park a block down the street from Sheriff's apartment. The previous night, he'd found a low wall that offered a decent vantage point where he could stretch and keep an eye on Sheriff's building without drawing too much attention to himself. It was a mile and a half to the park. After 1 mile, Rapp stopped at a public phone and punched in an international calling card number using the knuckle of his forefinger. When he heard the dial tone, he punched in the number for the phone service. 5 seconds later, he heard the pre-recorded greeting. At the beep, he left a coded message in Arabic that told Hurley everything was proceeding according to plan, which technically was the case, but probably not for much longer. Rapp carefully placed the phone back in the cradle and took off for the park. He circled the entire area twice and saw nothing that would lead him to believe that there was any surveillance. There were a few doormen who were out sweeping, a couple of early morning exercisers, and some people walking their dogs, but no police. Rapp entered the park at 7:41 and settled in by the wall. He started stretching his calves, first his right for 30 seconds and then his left. He'd positioned himself so that he had a clear view of the front of Sharif's apartment building. There was no wind, and Rapp guessed the temperature was in the high 50s. According to the Brits, Sharif's apartment was one of two on the 5th floor. It was a big place, totaling 4,500 square feet. His mother, his wife, and one of his daughters lived with him. Rapp started on his calisthenics and kept track of the people entering and leaving his corner of the park. Every minute or so, a pedestrian passed just outside the park. None of them paid him an ounce of attention. It was the same the world over. Most of these people had been sound asleep 30 minutes ago, and they were now off to start their daily grind. They would be lucky if they were fully awake by the time they reached their offices. Rapp did 50 push-ups, followed by 50 sit-ups, and then stretched some more. At 8, he checked the apartment door, and his pulse quickened just a touch. At 8:05, he frowned and started to doubt the accuracy of the surveillance report. Then, at 8:07, the apartment building's doorman stepped outside and held the door open for a plump man and a little brown dachshund. The man was wearing sunglasses and a long black trench coat. He had his collar turned up against the morning chill. The sunglasses, coat, and dog all matched the photos from the surveillance report. It was Sharif. Rapp glanced at the open park bench about 80 feet to his left and started doing more sit-ups. Every time he rose, he could look over the wall and see Sharif moving closer with his dog. Every time he lowered himself to the ground, he thought of his orders. The plan was for Rapp to arrive 2 days early and conduct counter-surveillance to make sure they weren't being watched. He would then call the service and flash them the all-clear. Hurley and Richards would arrive on the 3rd day, and they would begin direct surveillance on the target for a minimum of 5 days. If all went well, they would then make their move. Rapp let out a slight grunt, even though the sit-ups were easy. Sharif was almost to the bench. Rapp lowered himself to the ground and rested for a second. The entire operation seemed far too complicated, far too many moving parts, as his college coach liked to say. Too many places where something could go wrong. Rapp began another set of 25 sit-ups. Sharif was just arriving at the bench. The man bent over, undid the dog's leash, and tossed a small blue ball into a grassy area. The little brown sausage took off after it. When Rapp came up the next time, Sharif had a mobile phone out and was punching in a number. Kennedy had played a tape to Rapp and Richards 2 weeks earlier, on which Sharif implicated himself in a number of illegal dealings with known terrorist organizations. Rapp asked her where she got the intel, and she politely told him it was classified information. Rapp guessed it came from these morning chats on his mobile phone. Rapp did another sit-up and thought of Dr. Lewis, the shrink. The man must have asked him in every conceivable way
how he thought he would cope with taking another human life. Rapp had answered that question so many times, he finally said to the shrink, "Well, I guess I won't know until I kill someone."
"That's right," Rapp muttered.